New Mexico, fairest of them all, or so said young Ed Abbey, who hopped off a freight train in Albuquerque in 1944. He was one of many who had the fortitude to follow his own trail rather than bow to the mainstream cultural will. For three decades following World War II, New Mexico lured thousands of what Lama community founder Barbara Durkee called the Marginaux, the marginal people who live outside mainstream cultural coordinates and who pursue their own destinies. For Voices of Counterculture, this is Jack Leffler. Idealism fired the consciousness of many of the peregrinos, or pilgrims, who arrived in New Mexico in the 1960s and 1970s. Many who came to New Mexico were headed back to the land. The urban environments of the Bay Area and Los Angeles and New York on the East Coast had gradually become claustrophobic, too anthropocentric, for minds that had become expanded by the use of psychedelics. New Mexico was vast and empty, homeland to Indian tribes and with a harsh but beautiful landscape that invited the adventurous of body and spirit. One of the best known of the New Mexico communes of that period was called New Buffalo and had been founded on land purchased by Rick Klein, who used his inheritance to fund social experimentation rather than personal luxury. Art Kopecky arrived in the second wave of hippie communards at New Buffalo, where he lived and worked for the next 7 years.
We headed to Taos, and one of our purposes in life was to visit hot springs. And there is a hot spring on the Rio Grande, so we went there. And that happens to be a mile from New Buffalo, and we met some people, a gal in the water there, who invited us up to dinner at New Buffalo. So, of course, we went, and we never left. I mean, we started out that movement with this everybody notion, which is a beautiful, very spiritual notion, but it's not practical for running things. The last of the originals had recently left New Buffalo, so this was really in need of just our sort of energy, who wanted to settle somewhere. We didn't have money, so we couldn't buy a piece of land, but here was the land already purchased, and such an exotic setting. And of course, New Buffalo was another one of these out-of-space dreams, this elaborate adobe dwelling dug into the ground, circle room with these great big beams holding up the ceiling, sculpture of a whole buffalo on the wall, and then there was a buffalo skull there.
Dreams of utopia have claimed the imaginations of humans for many centuries. Here, Lisa Law, author of Flashing on the 60s, speaks of the profound influence that Indians from the Taos Pueblo had on the communards.
Well, when we were living in New Buffalo, we got to know the Indians from the Taos Pueblo. And in fact, we got to really get to know Little Joe Gomez, who was the head of the Peyote Clan. And he would have ceremonies with the hippies from New Buffalo and the other communes in the area. And they would help teach us how to grow our food. So our relationship with the Native Americans became very strong at that point. In fact, when we crossed over the border from Arizona to New Mexico, when we were driving there to live there, I could feel the depths of the soul of all these Native Americans in the earth of New Mexico. And there are 19 Pueblo tribes in New Mexico, and you can feel the vibe wherever you go, especially in those days. It's different now. You can't feel it as much, but in those days, it was very, very prominent, the vibration from the Native Americans. And that's why I stay in New Mexico, is because of the Native Americans and that vibration and how it affects the plants and the rocks and the dirt and the water and the trees and the plants and the rain and the clouds. And it's just an amazing state. And I've stayed here, living here, for 50 years because of those vibrations that we felt.
Iris Kelts, author of Scrapbook of a Taos Hippie, lived at New Buffalo and also felt the influence of the Puebloan Indians.
I knew Tellus Good Morning and Little Joe were the main ones, because Joe used to come to peyote meetings. He'd help a lot. I mean, the Native Americans in that culture were so revered and respected. And, you know, one of the things, just to connect that to present day, which I think we're all interested in, is, like, I really believe that the indigenous people around the world, people who do know how to live sustainably and harmoniously with the earth, should be our teachers and guiding lights right now. And I think that the counterculture in northern New Mexico, they did have that, almost to a flaw, because people would emulate them, how they dressed, and, I mean, they taught people how to build with adobe. They introduced them to the peyote church. They were incredibly generous in sharing their knowledge. It's like, we don't have to reinvent the wheel, how to live sustainably. There are people on this planet who we're probably destroying as I speak, who could show us how to do that. And imagine, with the help of modern technology, using their principles of sustainability, that would be amazing. The whole name of New Buffalo means the buffalo sustained the Indians for many years, and this is New Buffalo. We're going to be sustained by the earth. So I think of all the communes, New Buffalo was more interested in learning how to grow food and getting back to the land, whereas Lama was more spiritually oriented. We're going to evolve and this and that. New Buffalo was a little more earthy. That's why I kind of liked it. And Morning Star was a little too wild and anarchistic for me, a little lawless up there. And that's why New Buffalo seemed a good place for me. It was always that idea of growing and living sustainably. It was very, very dominant in the counterculture in northern New Mexico, which is interesting because it's not the easiest place to grow. The short growing season, limited water, and I remember all the peyote meetings were about praying for rain, and no matter how much snow or rain, it was like, we're always praying for more. They were just always so, like, aware of, you know, the need for water and how precious water was, and it was a very, very dominant theme.
Reno Meyerson has lived his entire life in the vanguard of counterculture. New Mexico has been his home now for half a century. Here, he recalls some of the history of the communes.
So, yeah, there were many communes established here in New Mexico. Perhaps, in many ways, the most profound was Lama Foundation, started by Barbara and Steve Zerke. Jonathan, who's up the canyon here. My wife, Cynthia, who's on the original board. They're still here today, Lama Foundation, and they're doing profound work, and it's several generations now in existence, and they're children of children who are there. And it's a fantastic facility, and it continues. Other places like New Buffalo, which was a very great experiment, and a couple of wonderful individuals took their inheritance and decided to do creative things with it rather than just exploit it in different ways. Some of that money went towards the building of New Buffalo. Anyway, there was quite a few communes. One of the first ones was Drop City. That was 65 or so, I'd say, probably. I came in 67, so I think, you know, they already had the dome up. Anyway, there was a lot of pioneering individuals came out here and started doing the most remarkable things. You know, a lot of the solar industry can thank the innovativeness of hippies for the development of many of the concepts that have gone into making the solar industry what it is today, just as a sample of the mind shift and so forth and the way people think. And, you know, we started knocking out the south wall of our adobe homes and putting up lean-to greenhouses and growing food in the wintertime, which, you know, nobody ever thought of before. These old houses are beautiful, but they were, you had to supplement some heat, but at the same time you gained so much heat from having this exposure. It was a huge, giant learning curve for many people. There's so many forms of innovations that, in many industries, really, that came out of the thinking that evolved from that 60s input.
Max Finstein was a beat poet who had moved to Taos County earlier on. He co-founded New Buffalo with Rick Klein, and thereafter spent some time on a kibbutz in Israel, and after he returned, he founded the Reality Construction Company. Again, Reno Meyerson.
Max Finstein, yeah, he was one of the early elders here in New Mexico. He arrived, he actually came out of New York, I believe, but he had been in the communal life from his youth, as had other people that I know here, like Gabe Katz, who was also one of these guys who grew up probably in New Jersey or something, one of these communist communes and so forth. These guys were already my elders at the point I came out here. Well, Max was also a poet, and he was an inspiring individual who really took a lot of us young minds and gave us encouragement and offered insight to how to pursue things, practical realities, as well as making observations of what was about us. And he died early on, unfortunately. It was one of the first funerals out here I attended. Yeah, Max was quite an inspiring person.
David Perkins has remained a communard at the Libre Commune in the Huerfano Valley of southern Colorado. He visited many of the communes. Here, he remembers the Reality Construction Company.
Reality Construction Company, well, they were very, very cool. They liked to work hard, but they liked to play hard. And that was kind of a good mix for us, because we'd go out and, I'd do, at least go out and make adobe bricks in the daytime, and at night we'd just have a good old time. And they kind of mixed it.
David Perkins and Roberta Price became members of Libre after traveling through commune country in the late 1960s. Here, David characterizes Libre, which remains an active commune to this day.
The people that started Libre had been through the ringer on the traditional hippie commune type of arrangements and had refined it one step, right? I was trying to come up with an idea of what I could say, why we've lasted almost 50 years at Libre Community in Colorado. Our ideal was to give each individual maximum freedom possible. And that still holds true. People had their own houses, they still do, of course. People were responsible for themselves. There was no communal fund, per se. We didn't have meals together in a communal space. We didn't share a building. We were responsible for our own shelter, our own financial upkeep, our own well-being, our own happiness. The idea was to have no leaders, no authority figures. This was the idea, and it still is, to try to develop a situation where you can have a community and still have that kind of bond and tribalism, but to have absolute maximum personal freedom with no restrictions.
Roberta Price lived at Libre for some years and wrote of her life as a communard in her book, Huerfano. Here, she tells of housing at Libre.
Obviously, the people that got there first got the best sites. No surprise there. And also, they were mainly Park Place. Gene and Linda and Tony and Marilyn were Park Place artists. So they were interested in building a studio space so they could make their art. So a geodesic dome was something that could go up quickly, could be a large studio space, and they could get back to their artwork, which was what they were interested in. Jim Fowler came slightly later, and he built a house by the entrance of Libre or someplace, and he had a much more organic approach and built a sort of hobbit house of his own design. And naturally, he was not somebody who was going to build a geodesic dome. It was much more found materials and sort of fantasy hobbit house kind of place. When we got there, in no uncertain terms, Peter Rabbit said, there's no space on the lower land. If you want to live here, you have to live on the ridge. So it wasn't as if we said, oh, let's go build a house on an impassable road with no water and electricity. Won't that be fun? It was like, if you want to live here. So the people that lived on the ridge came later and were told. Steve Raines and Pat came sometime before us, because they were starting to build when we got there in 69. Libre was started in 68, and the first domes had been built in the summer of 68. And Steve had an architectural background. He was much more into Gaudi and organic architecture, so he built an adobe. He and Pat built an adobe, but they did have an upper room with a geodesic dome on top, so that was a sort of transition place. A guy named Steve Vasey, who was also a painter, had been there before us. He did a very small dome and an A-frame on the lower land. We took psychedelics, were on the ridge. Steve Rains came along and said, why don't you build an eight-sided house built out of logs or built out of reject railroad ties? I think David might have been interested in the octagonal shape. We had both been reading a lot of Jung and reading about Jung building his tower, so we wanted to build an organic building and blah, blah, blah. So that we had no background whatsoever and no idea how labor-intensive it was, and the fact that we were building on granite or limestone and not much else. But anyway, in that sort of intuitive and irrational way, decided what we were going to build. And I think design changed a little as we go along, but we had that initial concept of an eight-sided house on the ridge with a huge boulder inside it. And the theory was the boulder was going to keep the house cool in the summer and warm in the winter.
Just north of Albuquerque is the historic Hispanic village of Placitas. Early on, Placitas began to lure Bohemians, who were sometimes associated with Albuquerque. Poet Robert Creeley lived in Placitas for a number of years. Indeed, Placitas is not so much a commune as a community of mavericks. Here, Robert D'Alessandro, a photographer from New York, characterizes his sense of Placitas.
Everything was open to happening, to doing. And when I came to Placitas, various houses were rented by different people, and when they left, they gave them over to whoever they thought was in the same mode and was looking to move in. So I picked up a house from Bob Polian and his wife on the condition that one room, that they could use it as a place to make sheepskin coats, which was how Bob was making his living at the time. But he was learning to build adobe houses. And the guy I had lived with in Albuquerque was an engineer from Sandia. And he was building some kind of dome thing, and he was building the structures for his dome in his garage and was going to come up to Placitas. So all this activity had been going on in Placitas that was very exciting to be around people who were just doing things. Everybody was doing something, and they were open to sharing it with you. People weren't trying to make money off you or hide what they were doing, and if you could help them, you would help them. And of course, helping them, you'd learn something yourself. So all this was going on. And then when we came up and moved into the house, the Thunderbird Bar had just started really happening. And the Thunderbird was an amazing kind of I wouldn't even say it's a bar. It was like a huge place where everybody came, and all kinds of things happened there. You'd have great rock and roll bands. Willie Nelson came there. Tim Harden was there, I believe. Just a lot of people. And Sonny Terry and Brownie McGee came. When you hear and meet people like that. Now, for me, it was very different than being in New York City, which is mostly ethnic and very city. And I came out here and I met people from Oklahoma, from Indiana, from California. And the California people were very loose compared to New York. New York is much more traditional. Of course, I was more traditional. And everybody just sort of collided and were very open. We used to have dinners that I called ethnic resources. I'd make spaghetti and sauce, and they'd make okra and whatever, you know, from Oklahoma. And it was just a lot of fun, you know, to do these things. And people would come over to your house. You would share various things.
One July day in 1960 in Sausalito, Greek artist and bon vivant Jean Varda invited us to go sailing on San Francisco Bay in his handcrafted sailboat. As I boarded the boat, I looked up, and there, curled around the top of the mast, was a skinny young man aiming a camera at me. He shimmied down the mast and introduced himself as Stuart Brand. He had just graduated from Stanford University with a bachelor's degree in biology and was soon to go on active duty as a second lieutenant in the United States Army. Stuart and I were to become close friends over the years, and in 2009, poet Gary Snyder and I visited and recorded Stuart in his home in Marin County, and we spoke of many things, including Stuart's inspiration to produce and publish the Whole Earth Catalog.
I feel like most of the things that we tried in the 60s were the lessons you get from trying something and it doesn't work, or it doesn't quite work, or something else does work than what you attempted. And so, you know, the various versions of the Buckminster Fuller Domes leaking played out across the board with drugs and sex and communes and God knows what all. Is there a mistake we haven't made yet? I've got one! You know? Everything was tried. Shingles was especially amusing. Then the wind would blow. So the communes were great places to try stuff and fail. And I was interested in the variety of that. And rather than kind of putting my bet on any particular one of them, I wanted just to help the genre. And so that was a large part of what got the Whole Earth Catalog going in 68. And, you know, if I hadn't been through the kind of stuff with the desert in the Southwest with you and Gene, and then trying to do a commune with Steve and Barbara Durkee, I wouldn't have had that frame of reference at all.
Lloyd Kahn is the publisher of Shelter Publications. He grew up in San Francisco and witnessed the evolution of the beat scene into the hippiedom of the Haight-Ashbury. Stuart Brand invited Lloyd to be the Shelter editor for the Whole Earth Catalog. Here, Lloyd Kahn characterizes Stuart Brand.
Stuart Brand has been extremely formative in my life because I'm in my profession now because of him, and a lot of other people are because we worked on the Whole Earth Catalog, and I learned how to put together a book working for him. And the first four or five books I did were put together exactly the same way the Whole Earth Catalog was put together, with an IBM Composer, which was like a $10,000 typewriter, and a Polaroid camera. He pulled all this stuff together. He had the financing and the foresight to produce it and to stay with it. I've kind of diverged from him more so lately than back then, but it might have been back then that I just never really considered his take on things, which is he's a scientist. I think people have a sort of an opinion or a bent that they will follow. And so Stuart's a scientist, and so he likes to fuck around with things, you know, like genetics and anything, go to Mars, you know, do any of this stuff. So he'll look for everything that supports his thesis, and I'll look for everything that supports my thesis, which might even, on GMOs, might even be intuitive. Like, I think that you just shouldn't be f***ing around with this stuff because you don't know what's going to happen. And also, you don't have enough reverence for the web of life that's been created naturally on this planet, that you go f***ing around with these genes, and so you say, well, people would be starving if we weren't making this Roundup-resistant crop. I mean, it just all seems wrong to me. So a lot of the stuff that he is in favor of now, I'm not, you know, and I'm just going to cop out and say it's just maybe it's more intuitive for me. I don't know if people recognize what a brilliant writer he is. He wrote these reviews for years and years in the Whole Earth Catalog and in the magazines that were like haikus. They were so pared down and so to the point. And another thing that he did was so complete in his access information. It's extremely accurate. So that was another thing that he did. But he's huge in the culture. I mean, and if you heard Steve Jobs' commencement address at Stanford, it's like a 10-minute talk that he gave 20 years ago or something. And he basically said that when he was in high school, he was reading the Whole Earth Catalog before Apple Computer. And he said that it was the Google of the times, the Whole Earth Catalog. So in a way, the Whole Earth Catalog was one of the founding fathers of the computer revolution of the internet. I mean, Stuart's huge in that respect.
Indeed, Stuart Brand has had an enormous impact on the counterculture movement. He is regarded by many as one of the most important of the futurist thinkers.
Well, I was in and out of the city, as we always called San Francisco at Stanford. There I am in North Beach, being an afterbeat creative person. And the communes fire up, you and I and others are bombing around in the desert and discovering Nevada and Mexico, Arizona, in Colorado. I wound up down the peninsula just because when my place in North Beach dried up, I forget why, and I was living in a trailer then, and then they had Lois come and join me in the trailer, and we got a nicer trailer. That was the whole Horth catalog thing, was basically an outgrowth in a way of Ken Kesey scene and the Perry Lane scene and then the La Honda scene, and we were out on Alpine Road and then up on Skyline Boulevard living in the trailer. And that was the Lorth catalog thing in Menlo Park. And I moved to next to Zen Center in San Francisco on Rose Alley or whatever it's called, and wound up with the editor of The Realist as my roommate, Paul Krasner. That was amusing. That was later written up as The Odd Couple because, you know, we were both sort of post-marriage and gallivanting and disturbed and dealing with all of the currents that were going every which way. It was great because he and Abby Hoffman were my exposure to the best of the New Left, I think, because they both had humor about it, and they would joke just as fiercely about the movement as they would about the establishment, where a lot of other people were way sanctimonious against the establishment for the being Maoist and a lot of stuff that was did not hold up well over time. But they were pretty great. Abby especially was amazing. You ever encounter him at all? Abby Hoffman. Paul was a lot of the inspiration for the Whole Earth Catalog for me, because The Realist, he wrote it all, and so he mostly signed it with his initials, so it didn't look like he was writing everything, even though he was. And I adopted that with the SB and the Whole Earth Catalog. And a lot of the things that he was doing with The Realist, I did very directly in the Whole Earth Catalog. So it was a privileged, strange period. And then we had something to identify ourselves as a generation with the drugs, primarily. And Margaret Mead was going around saying it's not good when the youth know more than the elders about anything. Actually, that sounds like a very good deal from our standpoint. Of course, it's been the deal ever since, because with various technologies and so on, the young oz know how to do the computers or the cell phones or whatever the hell better than the elders do. And I think that is to the good. And it's one of the reasons the young South, the young global South, is now going to own the world, because the global North is getting old and running out of young people.
Today we've heard from Art Kopecky, Lisa Law, Iris Keltz, Reno Meyerson, David Perkins, Roberta Price, Robert D'Alessandro, Lloyd Kahn, and Stuart Brand. Voices of Counterculture is funded by grants from the Museum of New Mexico Foundation and the Christensen Fund of San Francisco. Our radio series coincides with Voices of Counterculture in the Southwest, a major exhibition on display at the New Mexico History Museum at the Palace of the Governors in Santa Fe, extending from May 14, 2017 through February 11, 2018. The exhibition is accompanied by a book also entitled Voices of Counterculture in the Southwest that is published by the Museum of New Mexico Press. Our theme is performed by Carl Bernstein. For Voices of Counterculture, this is Jack Leffler. Thank you for listening.